AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 52 for Thursday, April 22nd, 2010. Stinky gas guzzling bucket of bolts. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thursday night. You know what that means. We're here again, AutoLine After Hours. And joining me, he's back in the house. He's back in the seat. It's the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo.
Yes, I was in Long Beach. So
we missed you last week, man. We had Scott Burgess in. Scott did a great job, especially he brought in a sack full of burgers for us all to eat. The dog went crazy, but it's good to have you back here.
Glad to be here.
And always, as ever, David Welch, too, from Bloomberg with us.
Great to be here, John, as always.
We were just talking about you were down in Fairfax, Kansas.
I was down in Fairfax.
Yesterday. For the big GM announcement.
That's right. Paid off the loans.
We'll be getting into the news of the week, but joining us today, too, is Doug Feehan, who is essentially the head of Corvette Racing. I know that's not the official name, but...
Well, officially, program manager.
Program manager for American Le Mans Series for Chevrolet,
right? For Corvette Racing. Program manager, Corvette Racing.
How do you fall into a job like that? I mean, I got to believe every enthusiast in the world would love to run the Corvette Racing program.
Well, it's an interesting program. It certainly is. And having been there from the very beginning, watching it grow, it's become kind of a child for me. It's a, you know, it's like raising a kid. The reality of it is, you know, behind me and above me are just some really great people. I mean, the executives at GM, Mark Kent, my immediate boss. You know, the alignment with Jim Miller and Gary Pratt. Mm-hmm. Down to the crew guys, Danny Binks and those guys. I mean, they're the people that make it go. You know, somebody's got to be up front to take care of certain business aspects of it. But the success of that team is based on the people.
You've been in a motorhead, a racing fanatic, though, I got to believe, ever since you saw your first car.
It was, I remember it well. It was War Memorial Stadium in Buffalo, New York. I was 3 years old and at the jalopy races with my dad and my uncles. You betcha. I always wondered what that guy was walking around with that big cardboard box, and he'd open it up and take out those brown bottles. I mean, those are some of my most fond memories. Favorite guy, number 11, Larry Marks. Turned out to be the stunt driver in all the James Bond movies.
No kidding.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the rest was history.
So, big change this year for Corvette. You guys have cleaned up in GT2 ever since they created the category, it seems to me.
Well, GT1.
Or GT1, excuse me. And now it's what? Just the GT category,
right? Depending on if three races a year in this country, Sebring, Petit Le Mans, and then Le Mans over there were actually GT2. And all the other races in the U.S. were classified as GT.
So, tougher this year, though, huh?
Oh, competition is absolutely intense. I mean, you've got Jaguar, you've got BMW, you've got Porsche, you've got Ferrari, all of which have accomplished cars, all professional drivers, all professional race teams. I mean, these are world-class guys. These are the same guys that are going to be racing at Le Mans. So, I mean, it's truly global, and it's right there at the top.
Best closed cockpit racing, road racing in the U.S. since the heyday of the Trans Am Series, right now.
I would agree totally.
So if you're out there and you're into road racing, make sure you go to an ALMS race.
Because the cars look like the cars that you can buy, and you've got so many different manufacturers like you just rattled off there. You know,
the whole basis at GM is for Corvette is product relevance. You know, when you look at what we've done with the race car and you look at how that has moved back and forth, cascade engineering is what I call it, where we've taken a great car, which was a C5, which was conceived and delivered to the public in 1997. We began racing it in 1999. We took what we learned in that car. We then got together with the Corvette engineering team. At that time, Dave Hill was leading that group. All right, he recognized what we were doing in racing. So we brought all the good things we learned in racing, he puts together the C6. Which
talk
is
a little bit more about that, because that doesn't happen much these days. I think in the past that happened much more frequently, where automakers would use motor racing as a test bed.
For years, automotive makers have talked about it, all right, and have tried to make the connection. And in most cases, it was a stretch. All right. With Corvette, it's real. And it's now, and it's happened, and it continues to happen. And I'll give you a perfect example of that if we want specifics. If you remember C5, we inherited C5 because that's just how the program got birthed. But if you looked at that car, it had the little cat whisker grille openings. It had flip-up headlights. I mean, those things are not conducive to top speed and engine cooling down the Mulsanne at Le Mans, okay? Now, the guys at Pratt & Miller got together along with the Corvette engineers. They packaged that thing, and they made it work. And we got our first Le Mans victory with that C5 car and one or two more after that.
How much do they have to modify the car to do that?
Well, you know, it starts out as a production car. The modifications occur somewhat in the suspension, although our first car used production suspension componentry. You use a different transaxle to help handle the increased horsepower, right? And the bodywork isn't production bodywork, although it's shaped just like production bodywork. It's made out of.
But you had to do some things so it could breathe. The car could breathe a little bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was a different radiator. I mean, it was a. I mean, by all knowing eyes, it was a highly modified vehicle. But starting life as a Corvette, which is how the rules really were set up to do that. But when we looked at the performance of the vehicle, we knew that it would be a lot easier to do things if certain things were different.
Like what?
Well, how about this? Single large grille opening instead of those cat whiskers. How about flush fit headlamps rather than pop-up headlights? You know, we tipped the windshield back another degree. You know, that was a Dave Hill, that was a Kirk Benyon, that was a Tom Peters, that was a John Cafaro. All those guys getting together who are racing guys at heart, who understood the value in that. Now, you got to balance that against what you think the customer will buy. You know, is he going to be intrigued by this? Well, if the story is that these improvements are made derived from racing to make a better race car, guess what? You know, sales went through the roof. So then we took C6. We started with a 6-liter engine. We knew we needed a little more because we were going against the Viper at that point in time. So we wanted to have a 7-liter. So the guys at K-Tech, who are our engine supplier, who had done a lot of development work at GM for years and years, said, we think we can make a small block 7-liter. They went and did that, and we started racing the 7-liter and had great success with that. That really was the answer to our prayer. That filled a need. Well, then where did you see that 7-liter small block come in? Z06, all right? That followed that. So then we homologated Z06 and raced that. Now, all along, GM was looking at what the Project Blue Devil, as you recall, which essentially was the beginnings of the ZR1. So they knew the car was going to go over 200 miles an hour. Well, there's nothing in the library of cars that GM has built that has 200 mile an hour data to it. You know, the wind tunnel, you know, doesn't validate at 200 miles an hour. So they used our data at the race team. The race team helped them develop the aerodynamic package for it, develop the bodywork, the little front splitter, the little wicker across the whole tail. All those things came from the race team. They birthed ZR1. We homologate it, and we're up to date now, right, running GT with the ZR1. So it goes back and forth. And I can tell you right now that as C7 gets developed, you know, the race car is going to play even a more important role. Now we have Taj running the deal down there, and he really gets it. I mean, he understands the value in the transference of that technology back and forth. You got a great street car, you can build a great race car. Corvette lives and breathes it, and that's due to the wisdom of the guys at GM who saw the value in that. And I think as we go forward with the new GM, you're going to be hearing more and more about that. Product relevance, transfer of engineering, it's a win-win.
You mentioned John Cafaro and Tom Peters, designers. So yes. It's very interesting to hear you talk about getting design group involved early on.
Absolutely. First of all, those guys are great racers. I mean, those, you know, not everyone knows that. I mean, everybody knows about them, has heard about them. They're all famous guys in their own right. But no one understands that their love of racing. I mean, we spend a lot of time in each other's shops, a lot of time. And I think it shows in the product that we're building today.
So John races?
Cafaro?
Yeah.
I don't think any longer. I'm not sure that he ever sat behind the wheel in competition, but I can tell you he is a fuel-burning, tire-smoking, wheel-stand-in-action kind of guy.
Back in the 60s, GM Design designed the bodywork for the Chaparrals, a lot of it. And one famous, there's two cars that Bill Mitchell did, the Corvair Monza SS.
Which we've talked about and still looks good today.
And the Corvair Monza GT. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the front ends of those, both those cars were from the Chaparral too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And even the pointy nose with the plexiglass headlight covers that were built into the edge of the nose where the headlights were. I mean, you know, that was a great thing about GM back then. And now, Corvette's one of the most visible technical transference programs. These aren't cars of tomorrow. These are cars right now. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. That's why NASCAR is so out of it
and losing the audience. Absolutely right. Doug, you guys are running E85 right now, cellulosic E85. The American Le Mans series is really trying to push green and all that, which mm-hmm. is good. How's that working out, running with E85 in those cars?
Well, let me say this. First of all, it's working out wonderfully well. Quite frankly, there's a little bit of a performance edge to it.
Higher octane, right?
Well, it runs a little cooler.
And cooler. Yeah.
Which allows you to increase the compression ratio a couple of points, and that results mm-hmm. in more power. So there's an advantage to running that. Number two, we do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, right now I think GM has over 4 million cars on the road that are flex fuel vehicles.
Isn't the fuel economy lower for E85?
Yes, it is. It's about 20% lower.
So if you're running in the Le Mans series, I mean, that's a lot of laps.
Well, but here's the deal. The series recognizes that, and because, as John said, they promote the greening of America. They are known as the Green Race Series, mm-hmm. up into the Michigan Green X Challenge. We can talk about that later. But they compensate you for that. They allow the fuel loads to be different. It's really simple math.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we carry 20% more fuel than the guys choose to run gasoline.
20% drop in fuel.
Right. That's exactly. So you need 20% more to accomplish.
But don't you make some of that back with the higher compression ratio?
Well, that's the performance edge, and then they balance that with the restrictor.
Gotcha.
So really, these adjustments are simple math. You know, inarguable for the most part. And fueling, you would say, well, how about a pit stop? You know, the guy's only taking 80 liters, the other guy's taking 100. Well, they've accommodated that by the restrictors in the fuel hose. So they've evened it up mathematically so that there is no advantage or disadvantage one way or the other from an actual time standpoint. Now, as I said, the idea is we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. You know, global warming is a unique situation that gets a lot of press. Quite frankly, I take the position that paper doesn't care what you write on it. All right. So I can create a very constructive argument on both sides. Here's the bottom line. We know what we're doing isn't helping anything. We know we can do something better. So if you know you can do it better, why not do it?
Right.
You know, we'll take the consequences of that as long as everybody tries to improve on the lot, improve what they're doing. And that's what we're doing. We don't think ethanol is the answer, but we think it's part of a bigger solution. Mm-hmm. And it also provides a great training ground for educating people to not be afraid of the new methods of propulsion that are going to be coming for the automobile, because it's safe to say we're not going to be running gasoline. And as a culture, that's all we've ever known. I mean, aside from steam.
Right.
All right. And I haven't been around that long. All right. But I mean, everybody just knows gas. So how do you educate them to say, don't be afraid of something new? Mm-hmm. So if we're out there winning races with the 85 in our Corvette, mm-hmm. you know, mom can feel comfortable putting it in the SUV to take the kids to school, or dad can put it in the pickup truck and go to work.
You guys don't make a flex fuel vet for the market, do you?
We don't make a flex fuel vet, and that's an interesting question. And part of the reason that we don't, Corvette is a very low volume vehicle.
Right.
Now it takes, you know, there's a cost involved in making that over, and then there's also the impact study. The dollars were much better spent going into our high volume vehicles.
Vehicles like Cobalt, vehicles like our
Silverado.
I've heard it's only a couple hundred bucks to convert an engine to flex fuel.
Yeah, I can tell you in the bean counter world, if it costs 20 cents, you can't do it. All right?
I mean, thought all these hurdles were cleared at GM. You have this sparkling balance sheet, and money's is no problem.
Well, I think you'd only have to look at being able to pay back $8 billion in a relative Something has turned a corner here. Something's turned a corner here. So I think when we see what the first quarter performance is of the company. I think it's going to be heartening to America. And wasn't there just a study came out about people looking at American cars in general as opposed to imported cars?
That there is? That's one of the things we got to talk about later tonight, yeah. Because I find
that. I'd like to think that when we look at our new products like our Buick LaCrosse, obviously, GM builds more cars that get more model cars that get 30 miles a gallon and more than Toyota or Honda. And we're beginning now to tell people about it. People are kind of taking a look at GM for the first time in a long time for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
They looked at them as to why they were going out of business, and now they're looking at them for how did they stay in business, mm-hmm. and how are they going to be doing well in the future. But it's a great product. It's the best in the world.
Where should Corvette go in the future? Isn't there an argument now? Should you be doing things that are cars that are $100,000 plus, or should this be every man's car?
Well, the Corvette has always been outstanding performance and an outstanding value relative to the big picture. There is a faction that says, let's take the gloves off and go after the 458 Italia, the Ferrari. Well, how are you going to do that? The only way you're going to do that is with a mid-engine, lightweight, the whole package. And so there's a faction within GM that wants to do a C7 mid-engined expensive car and do the update of the classic front engine, rear wheel drive Corvette, which was still a measure of real world affordability to it. So that discussion is still going on. The mid engine car was very close.
Where do you come down on the discussion here?
I would do both. I would do.
As Chevrolets?
I was the one that way back when I started out Extremist, I said pull Corvette away from Chevrolet and have it a standalone.
It sort of already is. I mean, people don't say I bought a Chevrolet Corvette.
Well, and then
sold at the dealership.
When GM was going down, I was hoping Roger would buy Corvette away, lock, stock, and barrel from GM and just turn it into this America's supercar. But, I think there's a reason to have a Corvette that's like the next iteration of where the car is now. And I think there's a reason the money's out there. If you can build a mid-engine car for the price of a Ferrari 458 Italia with everything you got, and you sell a couple hundred of them, and you build in the profit and everything, so you are making a little bit of money, what's the harm? Mm-hmm. But they will probably end up doing one car.
But why not do that kind of a car as a Cadillac, is I think what I'm getting at. The super high performance. I mean, Chevrolet is supposed to be every man's car, right? All the bells and whistles, but at a price that everybody can afford.
Every time I think about that, there's just something magic about the Corvette and the name and everything about it. So if it's going to be America's super high performance car from General Motors, it's got to be a Corvette. I don't see a Cadillac CN all of a sudden being marketed for $300,000 to the general public. I just don't think it had the impact as a mid-engine Corvette that went toe-to-toe with the Ferrari 458 Italia.
Mm-hmm. Doug, where do you come down on? Where should Corvette go in the future?
I can't say.
I can't talk about that. Well, I can always say, but there's always going to be repercussions.
Yeah, I want to say.
In the reality of it, I come in contact with the Corvette customer. And let me say this about the Corvette customer. Different automotive companies, let's say, we know our customer. Mm-hmm. Well, that means he's between 28 and 35 years old. He's recently married. He's got two kids, college graduate, and make $85,000 a year and more. That's knowing your customer. And that's important. I mean, those demos are serious, and everybody uses that.
Except not every marketing guy I talk to has the same demos, and it's exactly the ones you just rattled off.
Exactly. Amazing.
It could be a used car guy talking about a 74 Dodge Dart, and he's going to give you those exact same numbers.
Exactly. The reality is when you go to the races, all right, and you see the Corvette customers, whether they're in the 300-car Corvette Corral or they're fans at the racetrack or they're coming around dressed in their Corvette paraphernalia, you get to know them by face and by name. So when we say we know our customer, we know Jim, we know Charlie, okay? We know Rosemary and her two kids, David and Jean. I mean, we know the customer. Price, performance, and utility. Those three issues, there's not a car on this planet that can compare to Corvette. There just is not. It doesn't exist. They are very unique. They've carved out that niche, and that's what helped them sell 35,000 cars a year, which matched the production capacity of the plant, which kept the quality up, which gave them great J.D. Power numbers, which gave them everything they needed to go out and literally kick butt on everything that they came up against, and doing it for an extremely reasonable price. From a pure marketing standpoint, that has value, and I think that's going to be pretty hard to get away from in today's world. You know, when you look at sports cars that have come and gone and in and out of the market, Nissan being a perfect example, they've been in the market, they've been out of the market. They've been in the market, Toyota, in the market, out of the market. From 1953, baby, Corvette has been in the market. They have never left. It would be hard to create a substantial argument that suggested you ought to go away from that formula.
By the way, you did forget that Camaro was in the market and then out of the market.
Yes, but Corvette not being the technological spearhead that Corvette is.
Oh, wait, what was the Ghost year? 83?
83, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't stop building Corvettes. There just wasn't the model year.
Right.
That's correct.
Go ahead. I would hope if they do the next iteration of the current concept, I hope it has a double clutch gearbox and all the tricks I can, which it will. It'll be slightly smaller overall envelope.
Which is good. That could make it lighter.
It'll be 300 pounds lighter. It'll get better fuel economy. But right now, you know, the car does pretty damn well.
Impressively.
If you look at the numbers of the ZL1 or ZR1 and the ZL6, it's incredible.
And look at those weight numbers. I mean, next time you guys get them, you know, run them out of gas and go weigh them. Because I'll tell you what, that new Corvette carbon car, I mean, that's a seriously light car for everything that's in it. I think.
What are you talking weight-wise?
Oh, I forget. What did Harlan say it was? I don't even want to quote the number because I don't want to get it wrong.
Right.
But it was an impressive number, and it was a real
low 3,000 pounds?
Yes.
Okay.
But what do you think of the mid-engine Corvette? I mean, Mark Royce told me recently that was backburnered or killed. I mean, it's just, you know.
Well, you've got.
It's not live.
Yeah. You've got a number of challenges that present themselves. And we'll get back to the price, performance, and utility thing, okay? Obviously, it's going to be a little bit more expensive to build because it's a more complex piece, all right?
The transaxle alone.
Exactly. Becomes a very, very expensive part.
Could you even do it on the same platform and build them down in Bowling Green?
No.
Well,
not the same platform.
I mean, you know, depending on what you want to build. I mean, at what level you want to do it. I mean, just building a rear-engine car for the sake of building one, yeah. But if you're going to do that, it's got to be a clean sheet of paper, and it's got to be a pretty serious effort because it's got to be good.
Oh, rear, I'm talking mid-engine. But
well, okay. You know. Amongst us car guys, we're pretty much talking the same thing. You know, I suppose you could take the car and turn it around, you know, use the same chassis and just
flip the seats around.
You know, I mean, you know, you could probably get there with that, and that'd probably be a reasonably economic way to do it, but I don't think you'd end up with the product that everybody would expect, you know, from Corvette. It's the gearbox becomes a huge issue because to get something that really works, you know, you need a minimum of 6 speeds. I mean, you're spending probably $25,000-$30,000 just for gearbox.
Wow.
You know, so, and then you look at what you need for cooling. You know, you're not going to do that with a single radiator. You have to have outboard mounted radiators, all the plumbing that it takes to do that. You know, there's huge issues in those cars. And then what happens to the creature comfort inside? You know, how many mid-engine cars have you been in where the cockpit temperatures are, you know, are something that are always have to be dealt with? And then you immediately remove the utility from the vehicle. No longer are you two sets of golf clubs, luggage, and go on a 10-day vacation. That's not going to happen. And so then, you know, you got the practical aspect. So maybe you only sell 2,000 of them. If you think you can make as much money in 2,000 as you can sell in 35, more power to you. But I can tell you this without tipping anything that nobody doesn't already know. When we sold 35,000 units a year at Corvette, it was, I think, the first or second highest per unit profit maker that the corporation built.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's very, very, very productive. And the car was still an absolute bargain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at that kind of mix, that's the bean counters coming into the deal. You know, doing it just because it feels good or doing it because you think you might be doing the right thing. At the end of the day, we're still in business.
Of course.
And we still have.
Yes. Of course, now, the whole separate issue, if GM wanted to go win overall at Le Mans, they could pretty much show up with anything they wanted that could look like a Peugeot 908. You can call it a Corvette, whatever. if GM had some stones, instead of Big Ed wandering around saying, everything's good, we're trying, we're going to do better, you know, they'd say, you know what, let's put our stake in the ground. Let's go win overall. Let's get Pratt and Miller, all the boys
but
together.
But do it right. And commit do it to right. do it right. Don't do it like Cadillac.
There hasn't been an American car to win Le Mans since the 60s, Ford GT. Mm-hmm. No American car has won since. It's time to write new chapters, and I'd love for GM to just say, you know what, we're going to do it. We're going to spend the money, we're going to go, and we're going to win. Mm-hmm. We're going to win with a Corvette. Yeah, of some
kind. The LMP rules certainly allow that to happen because there is no real relevance to production at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But what is relevant is it becomes a showcase for the technology that lies within the walls of General Motors. That's what an overall victory at Le Mans really is about.
And, sure.
And you attach a brand to it because Corvette being the tip of the technological spear, if you will.
Chevrolet is now truly a global brand.
Absolutely. Exactly. But now we're also talking about a company that can't market their way out of a paper bag, who have never used the success that the Corvette team has derived at Le Mans, six-time champions. You know, I remember emailing Mark LaNeve, hey, you just won Le Mans again. I expect to see a double truck spread ad in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is General Motors. No. It's always like, well, I don't know, hand-wringing, you know, and they've never used Corvette or the success of Corvette. Now, when you go over to Le Mans, which I had the privilege to do, and you see the fervor of the European fans for Corvette, you say to yourself, why aren't they making more hay about this? It's the perennial question I've always had with GM marketers. They just don't get it. And they will show you, oh, we got reams of stuff. We do all this stuff for Corvette. No, you don't. You don't use it to showcase right. the corporation's right. technical capability. That's what you got. You win. But nobody knows. It's just like an afterthought. It's bothered me forever.
No, as it should. And I completely, totally 1,000% agree with you. And you know, you guys are going to go over and race in Le Mans in June.
Yes.
And I've got to believe there's a bigger market for Corvette outside of the United States now than there is right here. I got to believe they could double sales if they really started to push it overseas.
Well, you know, up until this recent economic downturn, there was a real dichotomy that existed there because you're exactly right, John. The demand was greater than we could supply, and here's how that works. When you're production limited to, let's use 35,000 as an example, which is pretty much what the plant operated on, because the demand is so great in the U.S., any cars that you would take and move to Europe was denying U.S. dealers the product. And because the U.S. dealers obviously were at that point in time responsible for preponderance of sales for all Chevrolet cars, and these things were distributed through Chevrolet dealerships, they carry a lot of weight. And so they would raise a ruckus. You know, why are you sending so many cars over to Europe when I'm sitting around and I can't get what I need to?
Then you go to the UAW and say, hey, let's double shift this thing. Let's triple shift this place.
Well, it's certainly possible. And at times we have actually staffed up.
Plus but currency, you could sell the car at a great value in Europe.
Oh, there's no question.
Maybe
and we did. I think we got up to almost 8,000 units a year.
Well, you don't remember, but I want to say in 1978, if I remember the numbers right, Chevrolet sold 75,000 Corvettes that year.
Yeah, that was also sort
it's a different world, you know, different
also,
era. I understand all
that.
It's
also a very bad car, too.
Well, I understand, but all I'm saying is I got to believe that as Chevrolet has now been turned into a global brand, it's growing like crazy in Europe of all places.
Well, I got to say,
what a halo car.
Let's open a Corvette plant in Shanghai. Yeah, you want to build, do you want to sell Corvettes? Go win Le Mans overall. Say it's a Corvette. Build it in China.
No, I say go win Le Mans overall and build a second Bowling Green plant. No need to go to China to build it.
Well, you know, the Asian market, there's actually, now we don't sell the car in Japan, okay? But there are actually publications in Japan dedicated to Corvette, like Vet Views, Vet Magazine. That exists.
This is about a gray market of cars over there?
Oh, yeah. Cars move all over the planet, you bet.
I know, but I mean, do a lot of vets show up in Japan that
yes,
way?
Yes, because they're coveted over there. And the reason for that is what we began to demonstrate by racing at Le Mans. You know, I can tell you that Corvette
so
prior...
Wait, why aren't you rolling this out, you know, Europe and Asia?
Because I only run Corvette racing. I'm trying to educate people. They're getting smarter every day.
So you never talk to the guys who have their...
I talk to the guys all the time, and they talk to me all the time. And we have an open dialogue. I wish it were that simple. It's not. It's getting better. And I think it's going to continue to get better.
So Corvettes and Chevy dealerships around the globe and put a ZR1 in a Cadillac dealership.
They love the cars. But when we started going to Le Mans, they looked at Corvette as a gas-guzzling, stinky, pollutant bucket of bolts, all right? And quite frankly, their perception was that they were owned by drug dealers, whores, and pimps. That was the image that Corvette had over there. It was terrible. Mm-hmm. We go and we win our first race, which was cool, all right? And I think that was 2001, okay? We had been there in 2000, finished third, and then we won the second year there. I go back the third year, and I'm downtown at a function, and I come out, and there's flyers all over the windshield. Every car, for as far as you could see in downtown Le Mans. Le Mans is a big town. I mean, it's got 275,000 people in it. I'm thinking, what the heck is that? And I go up to it, and it's a bus schedule. In the Sarthe region, they publish the bus schedule once a month and train schedule, and they distribute it by you know. Well, there's a picture on it. You know what the picture was? It was a Corvette race car. I said, you got to be kidding me. Now, I mean, we couldn't have been, number one, we would never have been smart enough to think, hey, let's get our picture on the bus schedule because we didn't know that they did it that way. All right. Number two, we probably couldn't afford to have done it. They did it on their very own. They picked that car, U.S. car, Corvette, stinky gas guzzling, bucket of bolts. Win at Le Mans, guess what? Now you're on the bus schedule. That's progress. And that is the change that has gone on throughout all of Europe. I mean, it was race car of the year in Denmark. 2 or 3 years ago. Hmm. I mean, another point, I think in 2007, each year race car engineers get together in Germany at some annual deal, all right? And there's an award that's given for Race Engine of the Year, and it covers the broad spectrum. It's rally car, it's Formula One, it's ALMS, it's everything. Everybody is considered, okay? Over Renault in Formula One when Renault was kicking butt, over Ferrari when Ferrari was kicking butt, over everything that went on, Cosworth, you name it, Corvette wins the International Race Engine of the Year. I mean, that's a pretty prestigious award for a pushrod, two-valve, you know, V8 motor. I mean, that's a level at which Corvette is now regarded on a global basis.
That's impressive because it's your peers voting.
And I think the team can be pretty proud of that because it's the hard work of the guys like Danny Binks and Ross Jeffrey taking that car to the front, the guys who were at K-Tech, the guys at Powertrain. I mean, just living, believing, and working to take Corvette from where it was to where it is. It's a great story. It's a great testament to the American way. I'm pretty proud of all of them.
No, as well you should. And in fact, one of the news things that we should talk about today, David, I know you guys reported on it, this AP poll that shows Americans now believe Detroit's making the best cars that they can buy. I think it might be the first time in my lifetime that Americans perceive that American cars are better than import cars.
First time in my lifetime, for sure. It is incredible because, the lines are crossing from both directions. I mean, Toyota is the standard bearer of great foreign cars. And
Was,
yeah. I mean, but...
Until they blowed up real good.
Yeah. And, and they have just continually screwed up, you know, nonstop here for about, you know, a good 6-7 months because this thing really started late last year. I've talked about it and written about this. Honda's lost their mojo. I mean, their quality is still very good, but their cars are just dull and you're seeing it all, you know, in their sales up and down. Solid company and everything, but not great. Nissan's actually doing pretty well, but you know, they've always sort of played third fiddle to Honda and Toyota. So there just isn't the buzz for the Japanese anymore. The Koreans are still upstarts, doing some great stuff, a lot of momentum, but they haven't hit that point where they're just, you know, massive buzz and major respect among all consumers yet. So then, you know, you got Ford and GM. I mean, there's a lot of good product out there from both companies, and people are starting to finally notice it. So, you know, their improvements along with, you know, the problems that the Japanese have had. I mean, you know, Japan Inc. in general is having some really, really big problems, and I wonder if that bleeds in a bit to the car business. I mean, Apple is absolutely kicking ass and taking names when it comes to consumer electronics, and, you know, you go to Tokyo and people surf Yahoo and Google. I mean, there's, you know, and now finally we've got American car companies who are competitive, if not better, in certain segments, and people are recognizing it. You know, and I think the economy and some of the problems, too, has played into this, where people have started to look, okay, have we gone too far with outsourcing and buying whatever we want, whether it's foreign or domestic, and have we finally just, you know, shot the golden goose with, you know, so you boil it all together, and it's very good news for these
people. Yeah, and the poll was in March, the height of the recalls for Toyota, so...
But even so, don't you consider this? I find this very significant.
It's very significant, and I would like to see another survey done, let's say, in August. And if those numbers stay there and there's no backslide, then I'll say, okay, things are changing. But this is significant. I didn't even put it on the site because it was just like, I'm still digesting it, you know?
Yeah. It's
like,
same here. We didn't...
It was just like, really?
We put it in today's news show. It was actually out yesterday.
Yeah,
I didn't write about it. Someone else did. I was in Kansas City, but, you know, I think it's great.
I just cautious to assign too much to it, but it is significant. If it continues, then times are changing.
We're going to see a big switch in the market, I think.
Peter brings up a good point, though. The survey is done at the height of Toyota's recall issues. So, yeah. You know, let's look at the survey again in 3 or 6 months. I think there will still be a lot of, you know, a lot of good news for the American automakers out of that.
There's definitely...
By the way, I don't think Chrysler's getting much out of this.
No, they're not.
Right.
I mean,
right.
They don't have the new product out. And, you know, they're so quiet up there hiding in Auburn Hills that... You know, they've just lost relevance to a lot of
Well, I mean, and I'm still looking at Sergio's product plan, and yeah, I still think the whole play is to basically buy a turnkey Fiat North America. Okay, I still think that's the play. But, you know, he keeps talking about, well, all these Fiats and stuff, and it's just like, time out. The American consumer doesn't know Fiat. Mm-mm. They don't know Alfa Romeo. They don't know Lancia. They don't know any of it. Yeah, the Fiat 500 is cute. You know, you want to hug it when you see it, when it's parked and it's cool. But it's just this supposition that there's a giant switch that's going to be flipped and that all of a sudden the American consumers are going to embrace anything Chrysler's got, whether it's a Fiat platform or a Massaj Chrysler platform. There's this, you know, there's this belief out there that this Sergio is going to flip the giant switch and it'll all be good. It's just not that easy. The American consumer, you know, is... They're just not that easy. They, you know, it takes them a while to...
Well, look, GM's had some good cars coming out for quite a while now. Chevy Malibu, to me, and really the CTS as well, these are prime examples. Great cars, arguably the best in their class. They're not selling the numbers they should be selling. You know, there are some reasons with CTS. They haven't had quite the leasing, you know, control of the leasing programs now that GM doesn't control GMAC. I get it, but still, it's not doing the numbers. Neither is Malibu. It's a brand issue. You know, Americans have recognized they're good, that they're still better than the previous models did, but they're not living up to their potential because of the brand recognition issue. So you go back to Chrysler, you know, if GM is a year or two behind Ford in its resurgence effort, Chrysler is, you know, probably two, three, you know, they're probably a whole product cycle behind GM.
Yeah. I would say GM's 3 years behind Ford and Chrysler's 3 years behind GM.
I'd say... 2, maybe 3 years GM versus Ford. Chrysler, I think, is an entire product cycle behind, which could be 3 to 5 years.
It depends what you're measuring here, because there was some reasons for optimism in the Chrysler numbers that came out this week. One thing that I was blown away by, you know, I like playing with the numbers, so I divided total sales into total revenue, and Chrysler's bringing in $29,000 revenue per vehicle that it sells. Fiat, which sold a lot more cars than Chrysler, is pulling in $17,000. Yeah, in other words,
subcompact cars is
Chrysler's pulling in 12 grand per vehicle more, and that suggests to me that once Chrysler gets its act together, and I still think they will, their profit potential is far greater than Fiat's profit potential.
No question.
Well,
you know, I pulled some numbers too when we were working on a story on kind of sort of a health update on the American car companies, and I forget the exact numbers. Chrysler's production first quarter this year versus last year was up, let's call it in the neighborhood of like 270 or so thousand cars, and a big chunk of it, or no, it was like 180 or something like that, I think, but like 100,000 of it was truck, and mostly minivan and SUVs. So that's where you're getting some of the revenue numbers, is that's what they've been building.
Right.
Now, gas is cheap right now, relatively speaking, although oil's been going up.
It has been, right.
And, you know, if it gets expensive again, that's going to hurt all three, because all three companies still rely on pickups and SUVs and bigger cars for their profits. They'll still sell. I think, you know, it's not like they're going to dry up if gas gets expensive because the passenger cars are better, but the margins aren't as good there.
Right.
The numbers I liked this week was the next generation 3 Series standard engine being a 3-cylinder turbo with 155 horsepower. And, gee, coincidentally, in Beijing, Ford introduces their concept car with a 3-cylinder turbo. So that's going to get interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fascinating. And I think Fiat's working on a 2-cylinder?
Yeah, they've got their 2-cylinders.
And I think Peugeot's working on a 3-cylinder now as well.
3-cylinder is going to be the next generation's 4-cylinder. I mean, it's just going to be the way it is. But a standard motor in a 3 Series being a 3-cylinder turbo with 155 horsepower, that's something.
Although, you know, one of the other things we got to talk about is Audi surpassing Mercedes-Benz in global sales and came within, I think it's less than 2,000 units or less than 3,000 units of catching BMW as the number one luxury maker in the world.
I don't think Audi is going to be denied. I think they will.
I think they'll pass BMW this year.
Yes.
This year.
Absolutely. Because they're making huge inroads in new markets.
Right.
And finally, in this country, you know, it always used to be, well, Mercedes and BMW, and, you know, Audi's kind of good. Now it's like you can tell, you can feel Audi is.
Audi's still significantly behind in the U.S. I mean, globally, I think they're going to do
it. In the U.S., you're right.
Because Audi's the kingpin in China.
But image-wise, Audi, I think, has really popped up in the U.S. Maybe the sales aren't there.
They aren't there yet. I know.
But the product image is really,
consideration is pretty high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been going up. So, you know, they got the hot hand.
Yeah, they do. Hey, I think it's time to bring in rapid fire. Ben, let's bring it up.
He was showing a 3-cylinder.
I gotta love it.
Okay, so let's see. We've got some phone calls that'll be coming in, but George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does the panel think of the future of Alfa Romeo? Peter, what do you think?
You know, I love the idea of Alfa Romeo. If you're a car enthusiast, you always have an Alfa you liked. Your first exposure to it might have been in The Graduate. But again, flipping a switch and bringing an Alfa over here, it better be a winner, and it better be, you know, price right and everything else. But I think it's a long road to get Alfa back in this country, a long road.
Hey, Forza Alfa Romeo. You know, I think the cars look really cool. And, you know, I'd love to be able to, you know, at least test drive a couple, maybe even buy one. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, they'll sell some when they come over here, but the numbers they've talked about initially, like, what, 60 or 70,000 cars?
Yeah, I mean, Sergio's numbers, it's just like, man.
I mean, what, last year, or actually even before the crunch, Audi was, after years of work, at like 85, 90,000 cars.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to know where Sergio, I mean, his numbers are just like, I'd like to look in his numbers bag, because, man, it's wild.
Well, you know, the Fiat recovery that he launched was truly great. But I don't think they hit his sales targets.
Well, remember, part of that, too, because I ran into Marianne Keller a couple of weeks ago, and she said, remember, John, $2 billion of those dollars came from General Motors in that put call, or the put that they had in that.
Right.
So,
put option.
Love to Drive wants to know, I'm a big Corvette fan, but I'm concerned that GM's pushing the Vette too far upscale and further out of reach of a middle-class buyer with a mid-engine supercar. Will there continue to be several levels of Vette with the C8?
Yeah. Well, first we got to get to C7.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll be around for C8. It gets back to what we said earlier. There's a perfect example right there, you know, of a customer who is a big Corvette fan who wants that entry-level, attainable vehicle. You know, Corvette has always been an aspirational car for anybody who's been brought up in the U.S. I don't care if you're 5 years old, you still liked Corvette. And at some point in time when you get your kids through college, maybe that's the time to buy it. We'd like to get you in earlier. But that price point is going to be absolutely critical. And I don't think that's a fact that's wasted on anybody at the corporation. I think they get that. So I don't think there's a lot of worry that the car is going to go so far upscale that you're not going to be able to reach it. Clearly, when you look at it today, I don't know what the list price is, but you could probably go and buy a Corvette at the dealer tonight for high 40s. He'd probably be happy to sell it to you for that if he's got the inventory to do so. Or you can go out and spend $103,000 and buy a ZR1.
Yeah, that's why the C7 is going to be slightly smaller, lighter, better, but they're not going to get too far afield from
it. I don't think there's anything to worry about. Car's still going to be attainable.
Salvador G wants to know, if GM really wants to be taken seriously by the rest of the world, racing and otherwise, why not go F1?
Well, you have to take F1 seriously first, which I stopped doing a few years ago.
Yeah.
But that's a bottomless pit.
Yeah.
I can lay numbers on the table for a winning Le Mans program. I can't do it for Formula One.
No.
So.
And the other thing to consider is, you know, up until recently, GM was a privately held company that had stockholders to whom you were responsible. All right. You know, when you look at great Formula One products, a lot of that coming from those socialist economies are government supported and government subsidized. That's not the case in the United States of America, which is basically a capitalist society up to this point anyway.
Says the man who benefits from what he's criticizing.
That's correct. But everybody deserves to make a living if they work hard. All right. I don't see that, quite frankly, as really responsible expenditure. I mean, there is a limit, and Formula One seems to have exceeded that. And by the way, if you look at how they're trying to restructure themselves, I think they've come to the realization that they may have extended themselves just a bit.
Yeah. Jim Campbell says, I'd like to comment on the Porsche running the Corvette off the road and almost killing the driver. If I remember correctly, Johnny O'Connell, the Porsche driver only getting a slap on the wrist. I'm not familiar with this.
That was the last race of the 09 season in Laguna Seca. That's what he's referring to.
Yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't Johnny.
It was Jan Magnussen.
Okay.
Okay. And, it's a difficult situation. Racing is an inherently dangerous and violent sport. At any given time, it becomes very unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea is in something like that, you try and come away with it with a positive. You know, what we did in that, we went back and looked at the damage that was on the car. I mean, Jan walked away from that. That was over a 52G hit.
Whoa,
52G hit, deceleration, all right?
Wow.
How do you survive that? Well, number one, we start with a production Corvette frame. Guys at Corvette Engineering, the guys at General Motors, safety first. Let me tell you what, that played a huge role in that. That's what everybody gets to buy when they buy a GM car. That comes built in. That's already done. Secondarily, we looked at the seat design. He had a fractured tailbone, okay? And we looked at the opening for which the center belt came through. And we saw that that was moved back just a little bit further than it needed to be. And what happened, he went up, first time came down, he hit the edge of that hole. And that's what caused that damage to that tailbone. Well, guess what? We went back and re-engineered that seat. You know, sometimes it takes incidents like that, catastrophic incidents, to help you get better. And it's not just in ALMS racing. I mean, we've seen it at Indy. It's how all great safety measures have come into motorsports, is through catastrophic occurrences.
Mm-hmm.
We took what could have been considered a negative, turned it into a positive, did an engineering study on it, and we know we're going to be better.
I hope I never see 52 Gs in my life.
Yeah.
That'll probably be the end of it.
That was a wheel-to-wheel battle over the last three laps of the race, and Jan ended up getting turned into not a safer barrier, but the old-fashioned cement barriers. Mm. It was ugly.
That would have been ugly. Okay, Mark O'Grady says, my question for Mr. Feehan is with regards to my fellow Canadian and one of the greatest road racers ever, Ron Fellows. I'm curious if Ron has ever driven one of the new Corvette Racing Team's C6R GT2 class Corvettes. Sure miss seeing him competing with the team.
You know what? We all miss Ron. You know, two guys started that program when we got it up and running. It was a Ron, and actually it was a second driver. Chris Neifel was the first one, but they came out within weeks of each other, had known each other, had raced against each other in Trans Am, were great competitors and great friends, and had a terrific ability to interpret, you know, how a car reacts on the racetrack. And that's why we used them early on to help develop that car. Ron has a tremendous following in Canada and throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as big in Europe. We certainly miss him. I think he misses part of it. He has a number of business interests. You know, it was a perfect confluence of things that helped the timing with that. He recognized he wanted to spend a little more time on some of his NASCAR stuff, some of his private business entities, you know, and it was just a great time to step away. He still works as an ambassador. He was just at Long Beach. He still interacts with the Corvette clubs. He still does his driving school out at Spring Mountain. I mean, he's still involved. He will not be forgotten. He's a great competitor and really is largely responsible for all the things Corvette achieved.
Isn't he the only guy to ever have a production Corvette?
The Ron Fellows limited edition
the
Corvette.
The only man to ever have That's a correct. Production Corvette named after.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I think that pretty much tells you how revered he is inside as well as outside.
Yeah. Let's read one more, and then Ben will go to one of the phone calls. But 007 Mitch W. says, as a client, what engineering element from the racing group is most important to Chevrolet?
Well, if he's talking about a single issue, I don't think we can limit it to a single issue.
Okay.
You know, it's across the board, and it's all the things we talked about. The aerodynamic aspect of it, you know, fuel efficiency, all these things come into racing. Let's look at racing as a microcosm of production cars today, things that are relevant that matter today, all right? When a guy goes out to buy a car today, or a girl, you know, he's going to look at, first of all, how cool does the car look? There has to be that physical attraction there. Two, what kind of fuel economy does it get? What kind of performance can I expect? You know, what's it going to be like on maintenance? Guess what? Those things are exactly the same things we look at in racing. You know, we look for the sleekest aerodynamic advantage we can get. We look for the best fuel economy we can possibly get. When we're in endurance racing, that plays a huge role in our success on the racetrack. We look at all the things, whether they be aerodynamics, whether they be ceramic wheel bearings. We're working with Mobil now on zero viscosity motor oil. Okay, that undoubtedly, when once we prove it within the racing world, we'll be in the production car world, which is a little additional horsepower with providing equal to or greater lubrication protection, 100,000-mile warranty on GM cars. I mean, we're looking at the same thing that the production car is. So consequently, everything we learn as a group immediately transcends and moves right up into the production world.
Good stuff. Ben, let's bring in the first of the phone calls.
Hi, it's Mike calling from Thunder Bay, Ontario. I'm just wondering if Doug has a bit of a wish list of what he'd like to see in the new C7, whenever we see that. What would he really like to see that he can use on the racetrack?
Is there still snow on the ground up there?
and by the way, I think it's pronounced Thunder Bay.
Thunder Bay, yeah. You know, if we don't need an evolution. All right. We need just a next stage. You know, we don't need big chunks. The car right now is so good. I mean, the braking efficiency, the handling of the race car, it's going to be very difficult to improve on that. So I think what we'd like to see is something that maybe gives us a slight improvement in aerodynamics, because that's achievable. OK, I'd love to see direct injection, because I know it translates very well to the racetrack in both fuel economy and performance, and it's relevant to the production car world.
Right.
You know, with you know, emissions and so forth. Those are things I think would be the two most important things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ben, let's bring in the next call.
Hi, it's Clem Zarofsky, Belmont, Pennsylvania. I know the new Corvette race team is using direct injection. How soon is that coming to the street Corvette? Thank you.
Are you using direct injection?
No, we had used direct injection, but in the GT2 class, okay, according to ACO regulations, It has to be on the production car to be able to use it in the race car. Unfortunately, we don't have it on Corvette at this point in time, and it does occur on the CTS. We do have it in the Camaro. I think it's proved itself there. We don't have it on Corvette yet, so consequently, we're not able to run that.
Okay. Let's bring in the next one, Ben.
John Marty, GMI 83, Atlanta, Georgia. Please stop the madness. Ethanol is a scam. Tests show when you run E10, your fuel economy declines 5 to 7%. A few points higher, and I'd be better off putting water in my tank. Can someone do a well-to-wheels test to see if there are any savings with ethanol? After all, the fuel was burned on the farm growing the corn, transporting it, converting it to ethanol. And I suspect we're burning more fuel than this crap produces. Thanks again. Love the show.
Love your input. I'm actually a big ethanol proponent. Go look at the Argonne National Laboratory reports on ethanol. And they do get into the wheel-to-well stuff. And one thing that everybody misses in the comparison of ethanol to gasoline is it takes an enormous amount of energy to produce gasoline, an enormous amount. You know, the average barrel, not the average, a barrel of oil contains 42 gallons of oil. You only get 20 gallons of gasoline out of a barrel of oil. It takes roughly a gallon of gasoline to make a gallon of gasoline. So when you start making the comparison on an apples-to-apples basis that way, ethanol actually comes out looking pretty good. But don't take my word for it. Go to the Argonne National Laboratory.
John, the only thing I'd like to clear up is the ethanol that we use at Corvette is cellulosic ethanol.
So not from corn.
It doesn't come from corn. It comes from waste on the forest floor.
Right.
So essentially Mother Nature's footing the bill for producing the product from which you're deriving the ethanol.
Right.
And but the caller makes a fair point here because ethanol does require a lot of fuel to get it. Making it out of corn is a really efficient way to do it. Cellulosic is the way to go, but is there enough stock out there to get really serious volumes of cellulosic ethanol?
Well, you've got grass-produced ethanol. You've got algae-produced ethanol. Here's the thing, and I'll go back to what I said. First of all, paper doesn't care what you write on it. So, you know, I can create an argument on both sides. I've done enough research on it. So, I can put together a compelling argument to support the caller. I can also put together a compelling argument that says otherwise. Here's the issue. It's not the answer. It's right. Part of a solution. And with gas at $2 a gallon, you know, it's hard to compete. Be the first to tell you that. You can't produce ethanol in quantities at that kind of pricing point. Gas goes to $6 or $8 a gallon, and he's going to be just waiting in line for ethanol because he's going to be able to buy that much cheaper than he can the gas.
Well, actually, I was doing some research on it this week, and one thing that's very interesting is in much of the Midwest right now, you can buy ethanol, corn ethanol, for 20% cheaper than gasoline. So now it's even, Steven, even if you lose fuel economy with the ethanol. Mm-hmm. And I would still say it's better to grow it in the Midwest than import it from the Middle East.
It gets right down to the dependency thing. That's what it's about. It's not that it's the greatest fuel
it's
ever
not,
invented.
It's not, right.
It's a dependency
issue. It's an alternative.
It's a great backup should something go south in the fossil fuel world.
And I think we've got yet another phone call. Ben, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. First of all, I'd like to say your show is amazing. And thank you very much for providing the show that you do. My name is Sean. I'm calling from Ohio. And the question I have is that being a Corvette fan most of my life, I'm 35, so I know this isn't very long, but always been a Corvette fan, what are the plans for the interior? Because it seems like Corvette has always been hit on the interior refinements. Thank you again. And look forward to hearing the answer.
Checks in the mail.
Yeah. Good question. Yeah, you've said Corvette's made a lot of improvements.
Indeed they have. And I can tell you, from the moment Ed Welburn got put in charge, you saw some major steps forward, both in exterior and interior. Ed understands. where we are interior-wise. And you only need to look and say a new Buick LaCrosse as an example, which is light years ahead of where we used to be. All right? And if you notice on some of the new model Corvettes, they're toying around with different products, whether it's the material that they're covering the steering wheel in, or some of the seat fabrics, or some of the treatments that are going on in there. They're learning about those things. The interior is a very, very, very expensive component in the car. If I'm not mistaken, I think the largest single component cost in a vehicle is a dashboard. And the componentry that goes in it.
That's true.
More so than
and
the
longest input. Lead time to tool
yes,
up.
And the most parts. So it's not something that's easily changed. Your point is well taken and well recognized within the corporation. I think they're well aware of where they are, and I think they're even more aware of where they need to go. And I think you're going to see continuous improvement in all our interiors, and certainly that includes Corvette.
Yeah, we had Ed Welburn on our show when we were at the Dream Cruise last year in Detroit, and we were talking about that very thing, and he said, almost verbatim what you said, just calm down, cool down. I know all about what we've got to do here. We're working on it, and yeah, they've made improvements to the current car, but Ed wants to get in and design it right from the get-go.
It's not something you can just flip a switch. It takes a dedicated group of people, which Ed is doing a marvelous job of assembling. And as it goes on, you'll see that continuous improvement. I can guarantee that.
Yeah, I will expect a huge leap forward with the C7. Absolutely.
When's that coming out, by the way? When's C7?
I was going to call in and ask that question, see if you knew. I'll just get my cell phone out now. Difficult to say. I think it's probably safe to say it won't be before 2013. But I don't know when. And that's just pure speculation on my part.
Well, we're at the top of the hour here, but Doug Feehan, it's been fantastic having you here. It's great. I mean, you got a great car to talk about,
yes,
but you're the perfect person to come in and talk about it too.
Well, thank you. And I mean, I can tell you, it's the group behind me that makes it happen. I mean, you know most of those people. You've met them. I'm sure I know Peter knows them. I mean, we have firsthand knowledge of them. It's a passionate group that is not satisfied with the status quo and is always pushing to make the car be better. And I think that's the whole mantra within the entire lineup of GM cars.
How about an electric Corvette, by the way?
Electric Corvette would be very interesting. Or a hybrid Corvette would be very interesting.
An electric one would be compete with Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we just have to figure out where we're going to plug it in at the Kmart.
Yeah. Right. And David, great having you here. And remember, everybody, you can always follow David's stuff at businessweek.com.
Right.
Always follow Peter's stuff. And great having you back, Peter.
Thanks.
I feel more comfortable with you being here on the set with us.
I guess I'll have to bring cheeseburgers next week.
And remember, you can always follow Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist, or better yet, just go to his site, autoextremist.com, and read everything right there. Follow us at twitter.com/AutolineDetroit. Just go to our website, www.AutolineDetroit.tv. And don't forget all that Stitcher stuff and whatnot. And remember, once we're done here, we're going to be turning this over to Miss Motormouth, Michelle Naranjo. And we're experimenting with some interesting things here where we're going to have open phone lines that you guys can jump into yourselves. But thanks for joining us tonight.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.